The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast, episode 695. It's the 27th of January, 2016. On the podcast today, I have Simon French, Chief Economist at Panmure Gordon, and we talk about Theresa May, Trump, Trump's wall tax, Trump's wall, UK GDP, and consumer confidence. Also on the podcast, full-time private investor Wheelie Dealer talks strategy and stocks, and also talks about the following stocks: BT, IG Index, and Air Partner Group. The ticker there is Air. Also on the podcast, something a bit different for today. It's a weekend, getting towards the weekend. An email from James, who's a fourth-year business management student at Edinburgh University, and he's doing a dissertation entitled "How and in What Ways Does Social Media Influence Trading and Investing on the FTSE and AIM," and or I think it's just AIM, basically. So James sent me this. He said, can you fill in the form? There's a survey there online, so I did that. I said, why don't you come on the podcast and ask me the same questions, and I'll answer them, because, you know, it's my specialty, audio, podcast. Let's do it in audio, not in writing form. So he's come on, and we go through a list of questions. I don't know if it offers some value. Hopefully it does, but I just give my opinion on social media and trading. Also, as always, today's suggested One Fear watch list, and it's flying today. I've just seen this. 7Digital. 7DIG has been submitted by Adrian. I'll go through the reasons why Adrian reckons you should add this company to your watch list in a bit. And as always, top five, as it's a Friday, most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 7 days. And the most liked RNSs over the last 7 days, too.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Chief Economist at Panmure Gordon, Simon French. Good morning, Simon.
Good morning, Justin.
Now, I've been watching also. I did switch into Theresa May there out for the Republicans, you know, really sort of manipulating the speech to please them in certain ways and saying certain things that would get a clap, you know. But she did say a couple of things that she suggested she didn't agree wholeheartedly with Donald Trump. But what do you think? What was your thoughts on that?
So it was a diplomatic speech, wasn't it? And it did focus on national security, a lot of the international elements, not necessarily at the forefront of traders' or economists' minds. But I think there was some read across in terms of saying the right thing on defence spending and also bilateral rather than multilateral trade deals, kind of teeing up that conversation that she's going to have this afternoon with President Trump. What was quite interesting, she's speaking to Republicans who are quite hawkish on foreign policy, particularly around Russia. So she could play to the domestic audience of standing up to the US and warning of global risks before she goes in and effectively has to be much more in listening mode with the new president.
You know what? I'm really intrigued as to how they get on behind closed doors. We'll never hear that. But they are, I mean, she did say, you know, opposites attract sometimes. And they are pretty much opposite, I think, aren't they? So it'd be very interesting to see how they get on there. And I think she'll probably be quite polite, obviously. And
well, the body language will be interesting to watch, won't it? Because, you know, the British journalistic pack travelling with her won't be backward in asking some awkward questions around whether she associates herself with some of his comments during the campaign trail, or indeed his more recent comments on torture. And clearly, her stance as Home Secretary and now as Prime Minister on issues such as human trafficking, human rights, you know, perhaps sort of sits quite uneasily with some of the stuff that Donald Trump has spoken about, and therefore, you know, you'll be looking for those signals. But I think they'll want to focus on the special relationship, as always, and potentially talk about a memorandum of understanding on a free trade deal, and that will be the thing that people want to get their teeth into.
Yeah, okay. And I always think it's funny that, you know, when she's initially, before he was elected, you know, and she wasn't a big fan of his, and she publicly said a couple of things, and I'm just thinking, you know, people never see, everyone's unsure of the future, but you think, you know, diplomatically, should never really, you know, slag off a potential future president, you know, because you never know what happens in politics. And like I said, the inevitable did happen, or the, you know, and people didn't predict it happening, but it did. And now she's got that awkward situation where she said those things. She's got to try and cover that up, you know, and move on. And you just think,
absolutely. And her foreign secretary is, you know, Boris Johnson, who's not averse to a gaffe or two, is he? He has said some fairly punchy stuff about President Trump in the near past as well. And what you've got is the challenge for speechwriters and diplomats is there's a fair amount of backsliding going on because nobody predicted this, either Brexit or Trump. And looking this year, you know, the potential for Marine Le Pen and what, you know, diplomats and politicians have been saying about her in recent years and the Front National. Will come April, come May, you know, the global leaders have to deal with her around the G7 table. It's quite possible.
Yeah. Do you know what? It's amazing. I was just thinking back of all the, you know, all the policies that like Clinton ran on and quite sophisticated in some way. And it came down to the fact that what stood out amongst this, you know, this election and what people ran on was what really stood out was the wall. You know, the simple as basic as the wall across America. We're going to build a wall. They're going to pay for it.
Yeah. And that takes us to yesterday's news flow, wasn't it? That he's going to start construction, but also the cancellation of this meeting that was due between President Nieto of Mexico and Donald Trump, because Trump is saying, you know, some way or other the Mexicans are going to pay for this wall. Nieto went no, at which point Trump goes, well, don't bother doing the meeting, at which point Nieto goes, well, I'm not going to turn up for the meeting. I mean, it's phenomenal sort of diplomacy. Yeah. You know, yeah. You kind of stuff you expect in, you know, the schoolyard has now taken sort of center stage with sort of global politics. But, you know, the point on the $15, $20 billion cost of building or extending the current wall, I mean, is it going to be that a 20% tariff on Mexican imports is going to be the way in which that is funded? But, of course, who will pay that import tariff? It will be U.S. households, and that is the difficult thing optically for the Trump administration. But then, as Steve Bannon reminded the director of strategy, reminded the press corps, press keep getting it wrong, and real America isn't listening to those arguably objective facts. They'll be listening to what the Trump administration is saying.
Yeah, we're always told, you know, to keep it simple, and I just think that there, just building a wall, is as simple as it gets, but that really worked, you know. To most Americans who voted for it, they like that, you know, the fact that you build a wall is as simple as that. And that's pretty much most of them probably just voted for him on the strength of that wall, you know.
Well, I think you make a really good point that I think we've spoken about this previously on the podcast, which is that the simplicity of language from some insurgent politicians, you know, on the Brexit movement, you know, $350 million a week for the NHS, take back control, some of the stuff you talk about, build a wall, they are in a world where some of the issues we're grappling with are incredibly complex. The simple messages are the things that get through to all people. And it's easy to stigmatize the people who voted for this as a different group of people. All people find the simplicity of the message quite appealing.
Yeah, yeah. Talking about things that happened that you didn't expect to happen. Now, we've had quite a, you know, after the Brexit votes, we've had a lot of good figures come out, haven't we? We've had, the GDP has been revised upwards or beat expectations, and also consumer confidence. So it seems to be going okay as yet, but like I said, there's a massive lag factor we got.
Well, so let's be really fair on what has happened. Most economists, myself included, expect the UK economy to be weaker right now than it currently is, because the impact of Brexit was expected to lead households to pull in their spending and businesses to defer their investment. That hasn't happened. The theory behind this being that actually nothing has changed thus far. And at the same time, we've had a softening of austerity through the last autumn statement. We've had an interest rate cut from the Bank of England. And we've had a large depreciation in sterling, which has meant that exporters have started to do very well because their terms of trade have managed to improve versus European and global competitors. So collectively, that's why we saw a growth figure of 0.6% yesterday, quarter on quarter, about 2.2% annualized. And heading forward, actually, next year, I'm more upbeat than the street. The average city economist thinks a growth of about 1.1%. I think about 1.7%, because I think at the moment we've underestimated quite how powerful all that stimulus I just spoken about is going to be.
Yeah, I always quite like the idea of consumer confidence. I don't know how they judge that. Is it someone saying, "Shall I buy those jeans?" Do you know what? I'm going to buy those jeans. I'm confident. I'm going to buy those jeans and those shoes. And is that
it depends how expensive your jeans are, Justin. Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to ask you on your sort of clothing purchasing habits, or but there is an element within the consumer confidence data that asks, what is your confidence to go out and buy a big ticket item, kind of a bit like white goods, a car, a house. It's not so much jeans, unless you buy very expensive jeans, Justin. It's much more the big ticket items, because if you feel confident in your household finances, your likelihood of having a pay rise or keeping your job or getting a new job, then you're more likely to indicate you're going to buy those large ticket products. Whereas if you buy jeans or a sandwich, it doesn't really broadly reflect whether you think you're confident on the outlook or not.
Yeah, and is there a price bracket on a big ticket item? Where does it start at?
Oh, you're going to need a statistician to give you the answer to that. Okay. I mean, I don't have the price bracket questions, but what's really interesting about it is the degree to which straight after the referendum we got a real collapse in consumer confidence, and also in the Purchasing Managers Index, which is really sentiment driven, which led to the Bank of England cutting interest rates in August. But it turned out to be a bit of a red herring, because actually you saw a real bounce back in August and September in consumer and business confidence and the PMIs. And actually, with the it seems like that was a bit of a poor signal of what was to come, and that the Bank of England arguably moved a little bit too quickly.
Yeah, so listen, if you're listening to this right now and you need some kind of, any kind of angle as to convince your partner as to buy a big ticket item, just say, listen, it is very good for the economy. I'm helping Britain. So there you are. All right. Marvellous, Simon. Speak next week. Thanks very much.
Cheers, Justin. Bye-bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is full-time proud investor, Wheelie Dealer. You all right, fella?
Yeah, good, mate. How are you?
Not too bad. Now, I know your website there, I'll put a link to that on the blog there. You diarised everything you do, and you said pretty much last year wasn't a good for you, good year for you. How has 2017 started for you?
I'm off to a really good start, so I'm pretty happy, I think, at the end of the day, I made a big screw up last year. I got my shorting completely, my hedging completely wrong, and it sort of wiped out any gains I made on my long portfolio. Whereas this year, I'm sort of positioned a lot better, and I'm basically using stop losses now on all my hedges, so, we won't have any of that silliness again. I feel quite well placed to take things on, really, and markets are obviously pretty bullish. So I feel pretty good about things, really.
And you employ a hedging strategy. Why is that?
Well, yeah, I mean, the way I see it is there's two sorts of downside risk that I don't want, And the first one is stock-specific risk. So, you've got a stock and the flipping thing comes out of a profit warning or whatever. It's hard to mitigate against that. You can do everything you can with your research and whatever, but you're going to get ones that go wrong. The best way to mitigate against that is diversification. Just hold more stocks. And then the effect of anyone's doing that is reduced, But then the other sort of downside risk is market downside risk. This is when you get a general drop in the markets and that pulls your portfolio down with it. Obviously, I want to try and avoid that where I can. So by using shorts on things like, you can short the S&P 500 or short the FTSE 100 or whatever, short the FTSE 250. And it just gives you, a hedge. It's like, your long portfolio is getting hit because we're having a sort of bad period, but your shorts are gaining money on the other side. So, that's the way I tend to work things.
Okay. And so you just to remind us, you have two portfolios, is that right?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I've got what I call my income portfolio, which is just 12 stocks, and it's really just based on big dividends. So, I'm big growing dividends. So, it's got a yield of around 5%. Well, it's actually slightly higher than 5%. It's yielding.
Who have you got in there? Name some of the companies in that.
Just the biggies, so it's stuff like HSBA, and it's GSK, AZN, National Grid, NG Dot. It's IGG, which I got hit on last year, which is what we were talking about, individual stocks getting hit. But I think IGG, it's massively oversold. I think that was an absolute steal now.
Yeah, because they announced that they're quitting their binary options, aren't they? I think, was that something I saw?
Yeah, yeah, they're cutting that. Yeah, they're knocking that out, which is probably not a bad thing, because that's just gambling, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, but we're waiting on the regulator to make their rulings on CFDs. I think once the news comes out, however it is, good or bad, if you see what I mean, I think we'll see the shares rally. But the trouble is, you probably won't see that news for months and months yet. You know, it could be a while.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, IGG is paying a dividend over 6% or something. So, you know, I'm quite happy to sit back and just collect the dividends.
Yeah, what's your take on BT at the moment? What do you think about BT? Have you been looking over that?
Do you know, I haven't really looked at it, to be honest. I sort of, you know, these days, I don't get that interested in stocks that have had trouble. You know, I'd rather, you know, you've only got a certain amount of money, and I'm not really a massively active investor. You know, I probably do, I don't know, two or three trades a week or something, you know, when I'm keen. I don't tend to trade much. And so I want to sort of buy things that are good and are continuing to be good and are going to get better. You know, stuff like Boo and that goes up. That's what I'm really after. And I sort of gone away from the bottom picking and stuff. That I know a lot of people specialise in that, and you know, a lot of people do really well on it.
Yeah, I sort of agree with you. It's a strategy that some people, you know, have done sort of well at. But I mean, with BT, I had a sort of conversation on Twitter, and I said, well, listen, at the moment, they first of all, they thought they'd lost $145 million. Now the thing is $530 million. But in their own statement, they're not quite sure as to the depth of this. So I said, I don't think now is the time to get in, because there's uncertainty within BT, let alone, and also, I mean, it, at the moment, their business is looking pretty flat, pretty much. So, I mean, yeah, I'm thinking...
Yeah, it's an exciting business anyway, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And like you said, there's enough risk anyway without taking on more risk of a company where you don't have any foresight, you know, future earnings guidance, really. They don't know where it's going to be. So I think sometimes, yeah, you know, bottom a company that's in trouble is a problem. Now, a different kind of problem, like you said, IG, I believe, strong business there, nothing really wrong with it.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's been almost it's a sector issue. It's not as specific to them, pretty much. And they are the biggest in their sector. And you think there, to a certain extent, you know, it's been priced in. The worry almost has been priced in, isn't it, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And you know, IGG are in a nice position of having a big cash pile, which massively reduces your risk. Mm. And of course, the problem is around CFDs and specific sorts of CFDs. And IGG do things like limited risk accounts, which, you know, the regulator's going to like. And it just seems a hell of a fuss, really, over something that probably isn't that big a deal. But, you know, I think bottom picking is an interesting strategy. And I know several people, particularly on Twitter, who, you know, just use bottom picking and they just want that bounce. You know, so the thing falls, it takes a few days to sort of calm down, then it starts to recover. And they're just looking for that sort of 20% or something when it recovers, and then they sell it and they move on. And, you know, there's clearly a strategy doing that. But I think you've got to be on it. You've got to be focused. You've got to be a trader. You've got to be active. That's just not me. I want to be chatting to you, Justin, on the podcast. I don't want to be sat in front of a poxy screen looking at numbers flashing at me all day. It just doesn't interest me at all.
Yeah, no, do you know what? I'm not like that. I hate, like I said, I'm not a trader. I'm an investor. Now again, I do a little trade. It generally doesn't pay off because I look at the company that I think it generally has mid to long term potential. I'm not in it for a daily gain or weekly gain because it can go the wrong way, you know. But having said that, so what stocks, if any, have you been looking at or you bought recently? What are you looking at?
A couple of things this week. I've been getting a bit excited. The big thing for me is this US market breakout. You know, the fact that the Dow cracked 20,000. I think that's massively significant. You know, a lot of people say, oh, it's a blow off top and oh, it's gone too high. No, I see it completely differently. I think the market's rallied up, then they've done a sideways consolidation. They had every excuse to drop. I mean, you know, there's so many reasons why the market should drop, but they've broken higher. I mean, that is an incredibly significant bullish event.
Mm-hmm.
So what I've done is I've actually gone long, not in a huge way. It's something, I don't know, I think it's something like 20% of my long portfolio's equivalent sort of value. I've gone long on the S&P 500.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I might be able to squeeze a few points out there. I've put a stop loss in below, you know, where the consolidation level is.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it went sideways. I've put a stop loss in just below that. You know, so if it drops back, then I'll be automatically stopped. But well, I'll be stopped out. I do it manually. I don't have a hard, firm stop loss with IG Index or whatever. Yeah. Cause the problem with that is it just hunts your stops and stops you out anyway.
Yeah.
So I've done that. The other one I've done is I did a trade yesterday where I've already been in Air Partner AIR. It used to be AIP, I think, years ago.
Yeah.
I've been in that for a couple of years or whatever and done really well on it. I think I bought my first lot certainly around £3, maybe a bit less. And anyway, they haven't really done a lot. It's been quite a frustrating share lately. You know, I've had them for quite a while, as I say. But they had some really interesting news the other day. They're doing a 5-for-1 share split.
Yeah.
So the shares that I bought yesterday at £5.14 will effectively become just over £1. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But you get five more of them. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So obviously the values, you know, the amount of money you put in is the same. Where it gets interesting is that Air Partner has been incredibly illiquid. And I think this is why I found it a really frustrating share. You look at the charts and stuff, it's as choppy as you like. It's impossible to read the chart. You can't tell what it's going to do 1 minute to another. But what I had got interesting is it's got very near a breakout level up at that sort of like, you know, 5.10, 5.15p level.
Mm-hmm.
But I think once the share split has happened and there's a lot more liquidity, I think you'll see a lot of people interested simply because it's now a pound. If it was cheap, it's a pound, whereas it was £5 before. Yeah. You know, no sort of understanding of value and stuff. The other thing is quite interesting. It's got quite a bit of cash. I can't remember from the number. I think it's about 14 million of cash or something. But some of it is from customer prepayments. Yeah. But it pays a 6% dividend yield.
Okay.
Which is pretty meaty. So, you know, it's got attractions even just if you just buy it and hold it, you know, it does private jet broking. So whereas in the old days, like if you were a CEO, you had your corporate jet, you know, I think did Tesco's have one, did I imagine?
Yeah, I think that they sell them off for something,
And they got into trouble for it, you know, because it's a bit naughty having a Tesco's jet just for the executives. So what they do now is they do these prepayment things on a thing called Jet Card, mm-hmm. and then they can just turn up at an airport and just get in a private jet and just fly to wherever they want. And of course, the shareholders have got no clue that it's going on. So that's quite an interesting. And then they've also got another thing. It's got things called Bain Simmons, which is quite a recent acquisition, year ago or something, which is like an aviation consultancy. It does like, you know, health and safety for airplanes and stuff like that. And that's quite an interesting little sideline they've got. So I think it's quite an interesting business, really.
Yeah,
and they
do
like big charter flights as well.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah. I'm just looking at the interims here. They've got they've got cash, including jet card, £24.6 million. This was six months
in.
Yeah, but they got net cash, excluding jet card, 5.2. So I assume that's what their cash is.
So that's their money. Yeah, that's their money. I mean, the jet card money is obviously, you know, customer prepayments, but it's still, you know, it's still something they could use if they had to, I think.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
You know, they shouldn't, obviously. But it just helps their liquidity, as a simple fact. I think, you know, in terms of running the business, I wouldn't surprise if they dip into that kind of thing occasionally if they have to for working capital and whatever. I don't think that's something that's wrong to do.
Do you know what? It'd be interesting to see. So when is this? Split?
Well, split's next week. It's happening next week.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's sort of pretty imminent, really.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see if it does inject some, you know, a bit of liquidity in there and see what happens there. Because, definitely interesting one to watch. Okay.
But I don't think they're covered by many brokers or anything either. And I don't think it's many fund managers. And it's pretty sort of off the radar, really.
Yeah, 50 million market cap, 53. Yeah, and it seems like it's turning over a profit. I've not heard of them before. So they've been around a while. Their gross profit, 16 million.
They've been around for donkey's years, yeah. I think, you know, they were around in the credit crunch. I remember that. They suffered a bit in the credit crunch, but then everything did, didn't it? But you know, they've haven't put a foot wrong. I think they've got new management in there because they seem much more into this sort of, you know, acquisitions and stuff and doing a bit more of trying to make it an aviation services business as opposed to just a private jet supplier.
Mm-hmm. Marvellous. All right, fella. Well, I'll keep an eye on those. Worth watching. Mm-hmm. Cheers, Pete. Well, thanks very much, fella, for coming on.
Right,
and we'll chat again soon, hopefully.
Take it easy. Cheers.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
All right, and joining me on the podcast right now is James Lawson Baker. And hi, James. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks very much, Justin.
That's no problem. Now, as a bit of an introduction, you sent me an email because you're doing a dissertation on investing in social media. So what are you studying and where are you studying it?
I'm studying business management up in Edinburgh, and I'm in my last year.
Okay, and do you invest yourself?
Yes, I do. Yeah, I've been trading on the AIM market for about 2 or 3 years. Initially, I started trading on the kind of the FTSE 100 250, yeah. And then I was kind of attracted to the AIM market. So I kind of put all my efforts in there, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, a lot of people do that. I did the same. I started off in bigger caps. Then you realise, you know, if you play it right on the smaller cap end of the market, you can earn a lot more, you know.
And
I mean, I did say on my blog last, you know, at the end of the year, my portfolio value increased by 67% this year, which I could never do in FTSE 100 companies.
Companies, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, okay, so you've got a dissertation. You're writing this. When's it got to be in?
It's the final hand in is on the 6th of April,
okay.
And that's like a 15,000 word paper, essentially.
Yeah, and so you've asked lots of guys you know on Twitter who've got a bit of influence and seem to be experienced traders and investors
exactly.
To questions. So, okay, so I thought, considering I do audio podcasts, I've sent you, I'm also filling your form as well, I think, so, but let's do it via audio then. Go on, fire away, hit the questions, and I'll try to answer as best I can.
Perfect, thank you so much. So, have you always used social media in your trading? And then when and why did you start using social media?
Not really. Only in the last couple of years I've really got into social media for trading purposes, you know. Before that, I just used it just to tweet out what I'm eating, essentially, and, you know, pictures of dogs and cats. But, I mean, yeah, pretty much last couple of years, I'd say, especially on the junior markets, AIM and stuff, because it's a lot more active and you can, you know, pick up some good stuff on there, research stuff, yeah.
Yeah, sure. And did you previously use kind of bulletin boards or was it straight to Twitter?
I never really was into bulletin boards. I mean, there's a lot of trolls on there and a lot of arguing and screaming. And I think a lot of noise. And sometimes, you know, it's best just get your head down and do your own research. So I'd say not really, no.
Yeah, sure, sure. So how and why has social media shaped your trading strategy?
It's good for finding out. I mean, it's a lot of, especially on AIM, which is the alternative investment market, a lot of stocks rely on momentum, you know, and news. So you've got a stock, then you'll get some guys. I love the way sort of social media works because you get a couple of guys doing some research, and they'll put it out there. And if the story's good, you know, it'll catch some traction and you can see. I mean, and I do a podcast every day and I get guys submitting, you know, sort of stocks for my feature called One for Your Watchlist.
Sure.
And I've seen that last couple of days, for example. I mean, you know, I've seen Hydrodeck, I've seen Connemara Mining. And a good example is Connemara Mining. Yesterday was suggested One for Your Watchlist. It's now up 32% today, and it was up yesterday as well. And it's almost like, you know, there's a lot of guys been pushing this out there, saying this is a good little company with, you know, lots of assets, lots of JVs. But then, you know, all it needs is that tipping point of interest. And so social media helps. And also I do a podcast that goes out to thousands of people every day, you know, very targeted people. So, you know, all you need is a couple of people sort of buying in there and a small cap stock worth, you know, around a million market cap, which is tiny, and it starts to move it. So,
Yeah.
So
how do your positions in the market affect what you post on social media?
I generally, I think it's the same with all people. People talk their own book, you know, and so every now and again, if I'm looking and researching a company and liking it, but I haven't bought, I will still sort of post, you know, sort of bullish articles and stuff like that, but, or bullish posts. But it's more so the stocks I'm in, because I mean, not only because you want them to do well, but also because you've done, hopefully, more research on those
stocks. More research,
Yeah, so, you know, there's no point in me just pushing companies hugely that I don't know much about. So I'm more confident in my research in the companies I own.
For sure.
Definitely, yeah.
For sure. And then how much attention do you pay to others on social media?
Oh, a lot. I mean, because there are guys that are good out there. There's some very good investors out there, you know.
Sure.
And they know when to get in. And also, because they have influence, you know, like I said, sometimes you've got a good little company and some of the bigger guys are not invested in it. It'll find it harder to get traction in the market. So, I mean, if some of the bigger guys are in it, it's worth looking at, you know? And
because
they can get it moving.
I mean, I've had exactly the same response in the survey that kind of lots of people are influenced by the kind of the larger traders on the AIM, kind of their kind of positions.
I wouldn't say it's a good way. I mean, the thing is, if you're a very good researcher and you can, you know, value a stock very well, I wouldn't say it's a good thing to do, because essentially then what you're doing is chasing a hot stock, and you should never buy a spike, you know. You should always try and buy a company at a reasonable level, always get a company at a cheap level. And sometimes, you know, what I've liked to do is I've found a company that's a quiet and lowly traded, but I know it's quite a good value company, I would like to buy it. And so you can see it on your own. You can see there's no stock available. You can buy some stock, you know, through your stockbroker, and you can hardly buy any. And that's quite a nice sign. And you manage to get some, and it goes up a bit. And you think that's quite exciting, especially when there's very little trade in that stock. But you realise there's hardly any stock available, because it will move. But I mean, but you also need a bit of liquidity if you want to get back out of the stock. But I mean, I'm more of a, you know, I'm not a trader really. I'm more of a mid-term holder, so I don't care about that. I just hopefully, fundamentally, the fundamentals of the business will win out. You know, mid to long term, I believe people will discover the stock when other people start to look at it. But of course, if I've done research on it, I'll share it. So I'll think this is why I think this is a good company. And there's a couple of stocks I like that. Other stocks you can see are very hot and they're working. You do research and yet they haven't risen yet. So, I mean, I will never go. And now I've learned. You can get burnt. You know, you buy a spike, you can get burnt, and you can end up. People are selling out, and when you're buying in, that's the wrong place to be.
Exactly,
if a stock is hot, I'll look at it, and if it looks good on the chart and it hasn't had a spike up, then you know, maybe I'll join in. You know, on research. But I mean, I won't just chase a stock. On a spike. Hopefully, if it's gone up like 100-odd percent, and you're hoping to go up another 100%, that's a dangerous game to play, you know.
Of course,
But that's for traders. I mean, traders can do that. They can take 10%, but I'm not into 10%. I'm looking for 100% more than in a small cap, you know.
Yeah. And to flip that question round, how much attention do you think others pay to your kind of Twitter profile and kind of the Vox Markets podcast?
I think quite a lot, because I get CEOs on. I understand CEOs. You know, they're running a company. They're very biased. It's their company. They have to sell the company. That's their job. But likewise, they are. You know, they have guidelines by them. You know, regulatory guidelines where they can't lie. They can't tell falsehoods. So what they say has to be accurate. So, I think it's a good research tool, the podcast, definitely, because it's one of the only chances you can get to hear the CEO talk. On the odd occasions we get very popular companies on, we ask for questions from private investors, and it's not often will you be able to get your question to a CEO and get it answered. So I think it's very good. And like I said, I often have excellent stocks suggested for the feature one for your watchlist. People have done, decent research. They know exactly, what the share register is like. They know how much free stock is available. They know how much cash the company has in the bank, what their assets are worth. So it's pretty good. And I mean, and if I write a blog on a company, I've done a bit of research on it. It's not just, I'm not just flipping a coin here, So, when you invest in a company, when I invest in a company, hopefully the odds are stacked in my favour by the amount of research I've done,
Sure. Yeah, completely. So how do others' reactions on your posts affect your trading strategy? So if someone's very negative about kind of a piece of your research, let's say, how does that affect your trading strategy?
I try my best. This is where it gets personal. Some people I've seen, you see amazing spats on Twitter and on bulletin boards as well. Because where money is involved, people get emotional. Now, what you have to do is decipher between, someone doing some research and come up with different answer to you in response to their research, or someone just trying to de-ramp a stock, and that means trying to talk a stock down because they have some kind of personal vendetta, or for some reason they've been burned in that company or something. So you have disseminate here and dissect the criticism you're getting. Is it about you? Is it about the stock? Is it about the fundamentals? What is it about? I always think if someone gives me an alternative opinion on a stock, it's what I've got, and it's decent research they've done, you've got to look into it, otherwise, like I said, you can take a hit, and and you've been given advice to have a look at the stock, and you didn't take it. So I think, advice is always good. But, generally, if I say something about the stock, I didn't realise something, someone points it out, that's got to be welcome, because that's information you need to have,
Sure. Yeah, yeah. So does your social media usage differ from kind of pre-decision to post-decision? So let's say kind of you're buying a share. Are you pretty unlikely to publish research before you've bought it kind of compared to after you've bought it? Or kind of what are your views on that?
Yes, because, well, essentially, I'll research a stock, then buy, and then, you know,
and then
sort of publish probably, yes.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, also, it depends. Listen, if it's a bigger company, it doesn't matter. If it's a smaller company, then... I write a weekend blog post, which I like to get people reading. So if I sort of, you know, tweet all that content out rather than have it on my blog post, then people will not read it as much. So and it's a more in-depth blog post. So I don't know. I suppose I won't start tweeting about a company unless I know, you know, quite a bit about them. But there are companies I've again, it goes back to you only know about companies you research about, really, you know. So you know, I'd only sort of tweet about companies I researched about and written something about generally. That's my point of view. But I mean the thing is, it's hard to decipher between the strategies of investment. If you're a trader, then you can just look at, you know, the amount of stock available, essentially. You can do a very tiny amount of research. But if you know momentum's with the company and there's very little stock available at a certain price, you can make a trade there and then, you know, regardless of what, you know, how much cash. Doesn't matter how much cash the company has in its bank or the fundamentals of the company long term. You know, you can make money within a day if you've got the momentum and you're buying at the right price at the right time, you know?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, sure. Sure. So do you believe that some people on social media then have the ability to influence others in the market?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Absolutely, definitely. I mean, it wouldn't be there if it didn't, you know. And so, you know, once you get a lot of big people on one stock, you'll see that other people retweeting, and it's like a snowball effect. And you know, it's tapping into people's fear of missing out, isn't it? You know,
yeah.
Everyone invests to make money. That's it. No one invests to lose money. And if you've got a chance or opportunity there to make money, and you're missing out on that chance, then, you know, you just don't want to jump in. And that's what social media is about on Twitter and small caps anyway. You know, people post, and you find a repetitiveness on sort of people posting. In the end, it sinks in. You know? But I've seen, you know, lots of posts about a good company was URU Metals. And
yes.
Very popular, getting traction. And I jumped in there about 0.6 pence. And I it went up at about 0.85. And then, I don't know why, I don't normally do this. I put a stop loss in about 0.65. Came back out and tripped that up. And then it rose up again, but I suppose about 80% after that.
Yeah,
and
sure.
And I was tempted to get back in. But I thought, no, I did a research. And even though I like the asset in the company, and there's lots of momentum there, lots of interest in the stock, it wasn't for me longer term, you know. And I just thought, I'll wait a bit. It doesn't bother me. But conquering that fear of missing out is to me, I think, is part of being a good trader. You know, if you just chase hot stocks all the time, you know, you will get burned. The most important thing is the price. You know, I mean, if you buy the right price and things are going in your favor, you'll do well, essentially.
Sure. So, how do you think social media, kind of on the AIM market, differs from traditional forms of media?
Social media on the AIM market. Do you mean in other types of, what do you mean, on social media just for small stocks or big stocks or what?
So no, kind of the smaller end of the AIM market. So do you think that kind of traditional media is less applicable and social media is the kind of primary route for news to be kind of distributed?
And when you say traditional media, are you talking about newspapers or something like that?
Yeah, exactly. Newspapers, kind of news on television, like those kind of means.
Oh yeah, I mean social media, especially on the smaller on the AIM style. I mean, because it's instant, you know. It doesn't have newspapers when they're published. It doesn't have the immediacy. It's a day late. That's yesterday's news. So
yeah.
when papers are reporting on a small cap company that's risen by, you know, 100%, that's happened yesterday. By the time that's in print, you know, a lot of traders are out. They've made their money, they're gone, you know. So, it's almost, you know, when the news hits on 7 a.m. in the morning, when the RNSs come out, which is regulatory news reports come out on companies, and if a company comes out with the good news, you know, literally it can shoot up by, you know, I've seen companies do a couple of 100% in half an hour. And yeah. Then, you know, you get the sellers who've made a lot of money selling out. So that will come back down then. I mean, obviously, by the time the newspapers report on that, that's all done and dusted. You know, there's people made their money, and they're out. So, yeah, it doesn't compete. Traditional media doesn't compete with social media because it's all about there and then, you know, the immediacy.
Yeah,
real time, you know.
Yeah, sure. So these two questions, the next two, are kind of following on from each other. So the first one is, do you think that social media has facilitated large groups of traders herding around kind of certain ideas, opportunities, particular stocks?
Yes, because, like I said, you have influencers. And if they put something out there and they've got a good track record, you know, of picking winners, then people pay attention to them.
People are going to follow them, yeah, sure.
Yeah, sure. So definitely does, yeah. So you will get the leaders. It's like society, isn't it? You'll get, you know, the people who lead and people who follow, you know.
And the kind of piggyback traders and investors, yeah.
Yeah.
So following on from that question, do you think that social media then increases the chances of people being able to kind of artificially manipulate stocks on the AIM market?
Yeah, I think it is, but I mean, it depends on the person you are. But I mean, if you do that and you're found out to do that on a regular basis, then your influence will become less and less, you know?
Yeah, true.
And I think unless you're a genuine person who tries to create some value for other people, then you won't have much longevity there in that arena. And I think it's the people who can, you know, constantly point out winners and admit when they're wrong. Other people who win out, you know, and if they're in it for the longer term,
yeah,
they're the people who gain. So you can't. I mean, you know, there are accounts. People set up accounts on Twitter all the time, under different guises all the time, and they're trying to ramp a stock. But unless you've got that influence, you can't really do that. So it's quite a just way of doing things. You know, you do get some people jealous of other people who are winning all the time, or doing quite well, or seemingly doing quite well. But I don't see why that's the case. Because I'm thinking, why don't you just learn from these guys? They're doing quite well. That's what you want to do. Learn from them, and you know, and I think it's the way forward. I mean, but I mean, if you disingenuous about companies trying to ramp a company to trying to get out of a position, you'll soon lose favour. And I think it's a kind of fair system like that. In the end, you'll have no influence, you know.
Yeah, of course.
So it brings into fact, really, it is social, and that's the thing. It's for an environment of people. It's not just for yourself. Of course, you want to make money yourself, but you realise, and this is why I love the game of shares a lot, is because it's a share. You're all sharing in a company. You're buying part of a company, and so you know, hopefully you want to share that wealth with other people, and that way, of course, you'll all need to sell at certain points, times, and that will differ. And you all get in at different entry points. But essentially, I mean, the genuine people are the people who share via social media what they think is a good investment. And they're not in it just to scam other people. They're in it to, you know, to increase their wealth and the other people on board as well, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Now, this question is kind of very focused on the small end of the AIM market. But how important do you think social media is in kind of changing and altering the collective mood of kind of traders on Twitter?
Yeah, it can be, I suppose, definitely. I mean, it's odd. I mean, you know, I'm on social media a lot, and I have no perception of what it's like to be a small cap investor not on social media. You know?
Yeah.
So I suspect. I don't know. I mean, if you are an excellent researcher in penny stocks and small stocks, then I think over the medium term, fundamentals win out. If you've done research. But I mean, get short-term heat into a stock. You know, you've got to. It's good to have an eye on social media.
Yeah, sure.
But yeah, it's hard to say because I mean, I know there's influence there, but you know, I don't know. I have no perception of the other side, really.
Yeah, I think most people I've spoken to have said that kind of social media is a really kind of useful tool in judging sentiment over kind of particular shares.
Yeah, yeah.
And that it's definitely kind of used by most people in their trading strategy.
Yeah. I mean, sentiment, definitely. But I mean, like I said, someone has to start the research and put that research out there. And that's where it gains that sort of interest, you know. And then when it's backed up by one of the guys who've done well, who are doing well, or recognised to have done well, then it gains more traction. But yeah, definitely. Yeah, absolutely, yes.
Sure. So from the data that I've collected in my survey, it seems that people themselves don't really like to admit that they're influenced by other people. But then they believe that lots of kind of other people are kind of easily influenced. What are your kind of your, I guess, what are your views on people that kind of piggyback trade? Do you think that's a thing that happens quite a lot on the smaller end of the FTSE AIM or not?
Oh, yeah, it does happen a lot. And I mean, do you know what? I don't see anything wrong with that, really. It's not, I mean, if that's your strategy, that's your strategy. If you know, like, it's the same as investing in a CEO who's done well. You know, you are piggybacking his experience. It's essentially the same with investors. If you are, you know, piggybacking a better investor, nothing wrong with that. You can also learn from that, you know? It's better than piggybacking a bad investor or you know, blindly doing what you think is right but getting it wrong all the time. So I think it's a way of learning. But, yeah, I mean, I don't see anything wrong with that. I mean, I, to a certain extent, it takes a while to... stocks are not easy to do, especially small caps. You've got to know a lot of stuff. And there's so many dynamics that go on. And there's the market mechanics that, you know, you have to learn. And I think if that's the way you do it until you find a strategy that you're happy with, that's fine. I mean, I don't think you can keep doing that strategy. I think social media is good because it does share a lot of information, research, you know, and it's out there. And I always say on the podcast, listen, these are just investment ideas. What I put out in the podcast are investment ideas. Nothing is investment advice. Please use these ideas and information here to do your further research. You know, use it as a stepping stone. I think there's plenty of time. Even though the market moves quite quickly, you know, a lot of the time, you know, the share price will come back, and in the meantime, you've got plenty of time to do research. You should always do research, and I think, you know, when you're starting off, it's no harm having, you know, setting up a list like on Twitter of people who, you know, seem to do well and following them. But always be careful, you know, and take care of the risk. But there's no harm in that, I don't think.
Yeah, sure. And my last question, Justin, is do you personally have a social media strategy?
Not particularly. No, I don't have a strategy at all. I mean, I genuinely will research a company and tweet it out. There's different types of research, you know, and I'm thinking, I try and give information and say, you know, this is, and I do say the stocks I'm tweeting about, you know, I'm probably involved with, you know. But it's information. I, every day on the podcast, it's just information. Don't invest on anything you hear. Please do your research. But I don't have a strategy as such. No, I mean, I don't go out there and say, right, today I'm going to really ramp. Because, you know, you see people and you get to know these people on Twitter who are very rampy, you know. And by that, they will keep talking up a stock all the time, and using icons and rockets. And that's fine. I mean, you know, if you, like... What people mistake is amongst those rockets and emojis that people use, there are some very good researchers, you know, and or they know their stuff, they know the game, they know how it works. But you have to find out who. I mean, that's it. It takes a while, even on social media, to figure out who's who. You know, who's just ramping because they want a quick profit and want you to buy in so they can get out, or who's ramping because they believe in the company and they believe it'll go further than the research. But as a strategy, no, I don't. I'll I tweet mainly about the podcast and guests on the podcast and on two accounts. One's under Vox Podcast, one's under Justin Waite. On my account, I pretty much do tweet about stocks that I hold, but hopefully most of the stuff I tweet has information attached, you know, rather than just saying, this has got a 10 bag, get in there, rocket, you know, and everyone knows this is going to $1 million. I mean, you know, I mean, because... You can't keep doing that. I mean, people do that. You can constantly do that. But I mean, in my mind, I couldn't keep doing that. I'd bore myself doing that. I mean, you have to give some kind of reason as to why someone should look at a stock, you know? And
as you said earlier, it becomes quite transparent when you see people doing that kind of consistently.
That's, I mean, my blog posts are written. I try and make my blog posts as easy to read as possible. Like, you know, break them down to 5 reasons why you should put this company on your watch list. And, you know, and I try and give reasoned arguments as to why this company is good value, you know, what they have, the potential they have, you know, and all that stuff. So that's the way I break it down. But sometimes you've got a story, you know. And the strongest thing about small stocks as well, the story. The story's attractive. It can catch on, and it's almost like what line from the story. Like sometimes, you know, I write a blog, I get a lot of traction. Other times, it won't, and you realise sometimes people pick up on certain things, and sometimes you only need one powerful line in a company story to get traction. You know that will appeal to someone, and so it's almost knowing that. But yes, I don't know. Apart from, I mean. I don't have a strategy, it's not a carefully contrived strategy. I just write stuff sometimes and put it out there, and hopefully it creates some value, you know.
Sure. So that's all my questions, Justin. Thank you so much for having me.
That's all right. So what is the? I mean, what do you draw a conclusion to your dissertation, James?
Yeah, so you have a few chapters. You have your introduction, then you have your literature review. So that's kind of focusing on all pre-existing literature around this topic. Mm-hmm. To be honest, there isn't very much specific literature in the realm of social media and the FTSE AIM. So you've got to kind of work around that. So social media in, let's say, Forex markets, and kind of explore that kind of area. And then you have your primary research area. So that's my surveys and my interviews. And then I have my findings. So that's kind of the last bit I'll do. And then I come to some conclusions, and I'm going to post that on Twitter on my account, because lots of people have seemed quite interested in seeing what the findings are.
Yeah, cool. So do you hold stock at the moment in any companies?
Yeah, I hold some stock in GEO. I bought that at 7.9p.
Nice.
I think there's a kind of a class asset there, fully funded, and I expect lots of news flow in the next kind of 100 days. So that's why I'm invested there.
Well, that's good. That's just below the placing price, so that's a nice place to get in. And like you say, one thing I always look at in small cap stocks, right? I mean, one of the most important things is cash. Do they have cash? Look at the asset, cash. And I've got this, I got this acronym I use all the time, called cash. And C is for cash, A is for assets. And at the moment, they've got two of those, and you managed to buy below that 8p placing level, which
below
is
that good. Placing,
so it should be. And what are they at the moment? They're at 10.5p that I'm looking. So
I think it's about 10.25 to 10.75.
Yeah, cool. All right. And any other stocks?
No, my last stock before that was Prospex, which I bought in at 1.02p and sold at about 2.35ish. But yeah, again, I sold much before, kind of long before the drill results. So I was kind of riding that momentum, that swing trade.
Yeah, but do you know what? I would look at that as well. When you're dissertation, you've also got to break down the strategy that a person has. So when you're questioning one person, you're questioning me, will be a different strategy from someone who's a trader. You know, I don't trade. Every now and again, I'll have a little punt on something that'll take my fancy. But I generally will hold for, months, and so that's what I'm going for, is months, really, rather than days or weeks,
Sure.
I'm happy to hold a stock for a year or so, a couple of years, if I think there's definitely potential in there.
Yeah, but, completely agree.
But, I mean, if you are someone who literally in for the 10% here and there, who will chuck a lot of money and make 10% on a trade, then there's different strategies,
Sure, exactly.
So when you went into, for example, Georgian Mining Corporation, GEO, what's your thought there? Do you have an exit strategy?
Yeah, I do. I mean, it kind of depends pretty much on the next news out from Greg. It should be expected pretty soon from the phase one drilling results. As I said, the main reason kind of going in was that I thought there was such limited downside getting in below placing price and with the kind of the hefty chunk of cash that they raised.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw kind of the in the last few RNSs, the kind of the phrasing geared towards lots of news flow in kind of quarter one and quarter two of this year.
Yeah.
So that was kind of my rationale.
But what's, I mean, when I say, do you have a target price you get out at?
I mean, at the moment, not really. It depends on kind of the next news and how that kind of plays out.
Okay.
But I've set my stop loss now, so hopefully it won't be kind of, I've set my stop loss at 8.5p and buying in at 7.9, so hopefully won't be losing any money.
Yeah, cool.
That's essentially it, yeah.
Marvellous. Well, James, lovely to chat to you, fella. And if I can help in any other way with this station, let me know. And
amazing. Thank you so much for your help.
Speak soon, fella.
Bye-bye.
Okay, today, suggested one for your watch list is 7digital. 7DIG is a ticker. Submitted by Adrian. Thank you, Adrian, for getting involved with this. I do appreciate that. Listen, if you know of a stock that you think has potential, please submit it, and I'll give it the air of publicity that it may need. And like I said, nothing on this podcast is investment advice. Please do your own research. It's only information on which to start your investment advice or help with it. What does the company do? Digital music and radio services. How many shares does the company have in issue? 116 million. What's the current price on market cap of the company? So it's 7. Do you know what? I'll have to check this now because as I'm talking, it's going up. So it's 8.625p 9.98 million market cap. But this was lower, so I'll put that in as well. So what revenue, profit, loss does the company generate? In their year-end trading update, which is on the 17th of January, they stated their revenue will be $11.1 million for the full year, 2016, and the board remains committed to being profitable at the operating level for the full year, for 2017. So heading towards profitability there. But the last set of statements there was their interim, 6 months, released on the 30th of June. Revenue was $5.2 million for half year, and they made an operational loss of $3.2 million. So they're obviously changing the business there to get profitable this year, 2017. How much cash or debt does the company have? In their year-end trading update on the 17th of January, they had £730,000 cash, no debt. There's three reasons why people should put this company on their Vox Markets watch list. Number one, profitability by year-end, both promised and achieved. Number two, massive growth sector. Number three, trading volumes increase, seller gone, and technical analysis pointing to a breakout with an 18 pence target. So it's 7 Digital, ticker 7DIG. By all means, do some research on that. Thanks for submitting that. Okay, here are the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 7 days. At five, Zenith Energy, ZEN. At four, Blue Star Capital, BLU. At three, Hydrodeck, HYR. At two, URU Metals, which is URU, ticker. And number one, most followed company in the last 7 days, is Ascent Resources. And listen, this is a very helpful metric because people start following companies, seriously considering investing in a company. On AIM, small companies, as I was talking about with James earlier, momentum is nine-tenths of the law here. Once people start investing, it's good. So you should always keep an eye on these lists. I mean, it's when a company starts to get interesting. And in my mind, if a company hasn't spiked, the share price hasn't really rallied strongly, then it's worth doing some research on, if they're starting to get some interest, if people are starting to follow them, definitely worth looking into. All right, here are the top five most liked RNSs on Vox Markets this week. At five, Zenith Energy commences work of a program in Azerbaijan. At four, Angus Energy, a Brockhamfield update that was yesterday. At three, Providence Resources, a license update in Southern Porcupine Basin. At two, Your Leisure and Technology, update regarding their investment with Electric Jukebox, and it sold out of the 2016 inventory. And at number one, most liked RNS, was Asia Met Resources, which is, quite an unexciting RNS, but it's a well-followed company. It was a voluntary delisting from TXS Venture Exchange. And, I mean, that is, good for Asia Met because it means less costs. So it's always good that when a company, it's an exploration company going to become a producer, but of course, as yet, they have no revenue. So every bit of money they can, every penny they can save is good for the bottom line. That's it for the podcast. Thanks very much for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.